This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Mahershala Ali, co-stars in two films nominated for Best Picture Oscars, Moonlight and Hidden Figures. And he's nominated as Best Supporting Actor for his performance in Moonlight. That performance won him a SAG Award, a Screen Actors Guild Award, last month. He gave a very moving acceptance speech in which he referred to converting to Islam. We'll talk about that later. Ali was in four seasons of the Netflix series House of Cards. He co-stars in the Netflix series Luke Cage, which is an adaptation of the Marvel comic superhero series, and he played Boggs in the first two Hunger Games films. Let's start with a scene from Moonlight. Ali plays Juan, a drug dealer who comes across a young boy named Chiron who's being bullied. Juan takes Chiron under his wing and becomes a father figure, offering the kind of guidance that the boy's increasingly crack-addicted mother is not providing. In this scene at Juan's house, Juan and his girlfriend are trying to reassure Chiron, who is upset because the boys bullying him have called him a faggot, and he doesn't know what that means.
What's a faggot?
A faggot is a word used to make gay people feel bad.
Am I a faggot?
No. You could be gay, but you never let nobody call you no faggot. I mean, unless...
How do I know?
Just do. I think.
You know when you know.
Hey, you gotta know right now. Not yet.
Do you sell drugs?
Yeah.
And my mama. She do drugs, right?
Yeah.
Mahershala Ali, welcome to Fresh Air. I love your performance in this film. Congratulations.
Thank you.
When I interviewed Terrell McCraney, who is the playwright that wrote the play that the movie's based on, he said a lot of it came out of his own personal experience. You know, when he was young, his mother was addicted to crack, and one of the guys that she dated was a drug dealer who befriended Terrell when Terrell was young and became like a really important presence in his life and a very a very helpful presence in his life. So that character that you portray is rooted in Terrell McCraney's reality. Was he rooted in your reality? Did you know characters like that? Did you know people like that who were both like drug dealers and could be very ruthless if they needed to be, but could also really be just kind of like, you know, warm and gentle and encouraging?
Look, honestly, the reality is that there's a lot of guys like that. And anyone who grew up in the crack era, you know, I grew up in that era, knew that there were also people out, and there's still guys to this day that are out there, you know, obviously drug dealing. But those were the guys who had access and had money. And some of those guys felt responsible to create opportunity for other people and were also aware of the dangers of their work and often aren't really the ones that are encouraging kids to get into drug dealing. And when I read Moonlight, Juan reminded me of several people that I knew, at least parts of them anyway, that I knew growing up. And I was a little surprised at Barry capturing that reality. That just wasn't something that
Barry Jenkins, the director.
Yes, I was a little bit surprised at actually reading that. I know I was blown away by seeing characters from my own life and people that I recognized on the page.
Did the crack epidemic have a direct impact on your life?
It definitely has impacted folks in my family, most definitely. look, I think that's true for most, if not all people, regardless of color, that grew up in and around areas that were closer to the nucleus of the crack epidemic. Like where, like if you look at, you know, what happened in, say, you know, Baltimore, D.C., Detroit, Chicago, Oakland, yeah,
what was your neighborhood?
I was born in Oakland and grew up probably about 5 miles from Oakland in Hayward. And Hayward was okay. Like Hayward wasn't very much a working class area, and had definitely went through a decline, and is now seemingly coming back around, which is nice to see. But Oakland was definitely where that was happening when I was growing up, where that was more of a problem.
Did you ever get into any kind of trouble yourself?
Nothing serious. I was fortunately able to avoid getting into any trouble with police. There was I remember I was 12, and I did something really. A couple of friends, Cinco de Mayo, we were off school, and we saw some people looking like they were having a party, and we had a little bit too much time on our hands, and so we figured, as kids, a great idea would be to throw some things over the fence and hit all these people with stuff like eggs and everything. Come to find out, it was post funeral. People were gathered together.
That's really
out.
Awful.
And it was, and yeah, so that was the time I got in trouble with the police. We got caught throwing eggs and ketchup on people who we thought were having a party, but it was post funeral, and that was pretty horrible. But besides that, I've been able to stay out of trouble, and very grateful for that.
So you won a SAG Award last month for your performance in Moonlight. I loved your acceptance speech. And for listeners who haven't heard it, we're going to play it right now. So it's a short acceptance
speech. I thought you were going to make me do it again.
You scared me
for a
by
moment.
Heart.
Like, for listeners who haven't heard it,
please recite it now. Okay, so here's a recording from the SAG Awards last month.
I think what I've learned from working on Moonlight is we see what happens when you persecute people. They fold into themselves. And what I was so grateful about in having the opportunity to play Juan was playing a gentleman who saw a young man folding into himself as a result of the persecution of his community, and taking that opportunity to uplift him and tell him that he mattered, that he was okay, and accept him. And I hope that we do a better job of that. You know, when we kind of get caught up in the minutiae, the details that make us all different, I think there's two ways of seeing that. There's an opportunity to see the texture of that person, the characteristics that make them unique. And then there's an opportunity to go to war about it and to say that person is different from me and I don't like you, so let's battle. My mother is an ordained minister. I'm a Muslim. She didn't do backflips when I called her to tell her I converted 17 years ago. But I tell you now, we put things to the side, and I'm able to see her. She's able to see me. We love each other. The love has grown, and that stuff is minutia. It's not that important.
That was a really beautiful speech that you gave.
Oh, thank you.
You were really tearing up when you were talking about people who are persecuted by their own community. It sounds like that's something you really personally connected with. Were you thinking of things that happened to you when you said that?
Well, look, I have seen it. I've personally been on the outside sometimes, but I personally was never persecuted, especially in the way in which Chiron experiences. But
I was thinking maybe you felt yourself folding into yourself, like you described during a part of your life.
Yeah, for sure. Because I think there were periods of times where I didn't feel understood, and there were very few people around me that I felt like they really got me. There was one person who was sort of the one in my life that really got me. And he's one of my close, I'm talking like when I was in high school, and he's one of my really close friends to this day. But in general, I felt a little bit on the outside and not totally included. There was a period of time when we were moving around a lot. So I couldn't really hold on to a certain set of friends. And so that was a little bit difficult. And also, my experiences growing up, my father lived in New York, so I was going out there in the summers and meeting really interesting people and people having what seemed to me to be extraordinary experiences and really taking advantage of these wonderful opportunities. And so I would go to the big city and watch these people performing on stage and doing television and films. And then I would go back to Hayward and it just suddenly felt that much smaller and sort of limiting, because I had this hyper awareness of how much larger the world was. And so I think in some ways I would go back home and I didn't really quite fit in and didn't have a person to bounce those experiences off of. So it felt a little bit trapped within me, and it made me feel lonely, because I really couldn't, the things that were exciting to me, I couldn't really share those with another kid and that other kid understand that.
Your parents separated when you were three. And as you said, your father moved to New York. You stayed with your mother on the West Coast.
Yes.
So your father was a dancer. He danced on Soul Train. Mm-hmm. Was he a regular on Soul Train?
No, there was a period where they did, at least in 1977, they did a national dance contest. And my father won that, and he won $2,500. I recently found his letter from Johnson & Johnson.
Oh, gosh.
in my storage, yeah. So he won $2,500, and he won a car. And my parents were. So they were kids when I was born. My mother was 16. My father was 17, and they got married in high school, and they split a few years later. So, and that's when they split, was when all that was happening. Also, and they were just coming into themselves, but they remained friends. My dad he moved to New York after he won Soul Train in the car and got settled in out there and was able to step right into Dance Theater of Harlem. And I felt like he was in a show called Omnibus and American Dance Machine. And he just started touring and being out a lot. And he was in the chorus a lot and understudying.
In the chorus of shows?
In the chorus, like of shows, like kind of one of the chorus guys, but then also being an understudy for one of the leading parts, or like in Dreamgirls, for instance, he was on Broadway with Dreamgirls, but then also in the national tour or one of the international tours, played James Thunder Early a few times as well. So one of the principals.
Well, I could see what you were talking about the difference between spending time with your father, who was in the Dance Theater of Harlem and was working on Broadway show. It was in a national touring productions, and then going home to, I forget the name of...
Hayward,
yeah.
The Bay Area, basically.
Right, in the Bay Area. But your mother was involved with the church. She was not living that kind of performing life. You were not surrounded by artists and performers when you went home. So let's compare your father's life with your life at home and with your mother's life. What was her role in the church? Was she an ordained minister when you were growing up?
No, she wasn't. Her mother was an ordained minister. So her mother was assistant pastor at Palmacia Baptist Church in Hayward. My grandmother, Evie Goins. And so my mother was doing, I remember when my mother graduated from beauty college. So I was about five. And so I guess she was about 21. And I just remember being there, taking the pictures and seeing her get her diploma and everything. But she was doing hair for many years. And during that time, she kind of started to discover or tap into her religious studies. It was around the time I was starting to go through puberty and hitting like 12, 13. And as a kid, you're starting to grow up and want more freedoms. But when you have people who are absorbing and adopting religious principles and teachings, they start drawing these lines and creating confines in their life to live within certain lines.
Yeah, so what didn't she want you to do?
So there was things just like not being able to date, or I'm talking like 15, 16, like mm-hmm. just certain things with, that my friends started to do, like they started to get phone calls from girls, or like, you know, go hang out 10, 11 at night, kind of going to the movies. There were just certain things that, it's not that I couldn't do all of those things. It's just that every choice was really deliberate and conscious and thought out and sort of balanced against the religion in a way where I felt I wasn't necessarily trying to convert at 12 like she was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, like it disrupted my rhythm in growing up. But I will say that I'm really grateful for her own personal transition. The freedom that I wanted as a kid would not have been good for me. And not in the way in which I wanted it. And so over time, I think how strict my mother's home could be with my mom and my stepfather, there was a fluidity and freedom in my dad's existence that I enjoyed when I was around him, though the responsibility was just different. He expected me to carry myself a certain way without all the rules and confines. And I think my mom gave me the borders, gave me a very clear understanding of what the perimeter was. And I had to find my fun within those boundaries. So between the two, it was a really unique upbringing, I think, especially for where I was from.
Oh, what two different worlds.
Yes.
So in your acceptance speech at the SAG Awards last month, you mentioned, you know, your mother's an ordained minister, and you say she didn't do backflips when you told her you'd converted to Islam. When did you convert?
I converted December 31st, 1999. It was a Friday. And I had gone to, that was my second time going to the mosque. The woman who was my wife now, my extraordinary wife, I knew in college. And I was really curious at that time, just in general, just studying different things from, you know, learning more about reincarnation. I had read some books on the Baha'i faith. I had read, I was looking into Buddhism and trying to understand sort of the agnostic approach. So there's a bunch of stuff I was just looking at. And then at that time we met, she was Muslim, but was at a point where, because her father is an imam and her mother, though, is a convert, but she was basically raised Muslim. And she was at that point where she was deciding or trying to come to terms with her own relationship with Islam and how to embrace that for herself. So I was sort of trying to come walk toward it, and she wasn't sure if it was what she wanted for herself. And so she kind of like introduced me to things, kind of like, here's this book, check it out if you respond to it. And so I went to a mosque in Philadelphia with her in December 24th, 1999. And we went to this mosque in Philly, and I just had such a strong reaction to the prayer, and I was really emotionally, I felt really grounded at that time. And so to be in this prayer, and the imam is doing the prayer in Arabic, and I don't understand a word of Arabic, but I just remember these tears just coming down my face and it just really connecting to my spirit in a way that felt like I needed to pay attention to that.
So you converted to Islam basically a year and a half before 9/11. So you converted just in time for a lot of a lot of Americans
just in time to enjoy all the benefits
about
of
Islam.
It.
Right? Yeah.
Yes.
So how did your life as a Muslim change after 9/11? And how would people project onto you changed after 9/11?
Well, that's where I think the connection with Chiron could happen is you
Chiron's
as
the,
Muslim,
the character of the boy
the character
in Moonlight.
From, yes, from Moonlight is. It was so many Muslims would tell you that they felt like, and still do, but especially then, that you had to you folded into yourself, because people were looking at you and recognizing you as being the culprit, even though, look, I'm American, I don't believe that the teachings of Islam justify those actions. I feel like those acts are un-Islamic. So to see that happen and somebody do that in the name of God, it just, and the religion that you practice, it hurts your heart so deeply because it's such a misrepresentation of the faith. And you're an American, so you're hurt that other American citizens have been hurt. But you end up having to shoulder the shame for something that you don't even believe. There's a lot of years where Muslims have dealt with having to make themselves very small and not disrupt the flow and make sure that you're not noticed because, you know, deep down inside, people are not really excited that you're around.
You know, it's funny, like Your birth name is Mahershala Al Hashbaz Gilmore, and it sounds like your first name is a Muslim name, even though your mother is Christian and wasn't thrilled.
But it's Hebrew.
It's Hebrew, really?
Oh,
that's
yes.
interesting.
Yeah, and I've been on. I remember after 9/11, I was working quite a bit in Vancouver, and then I realized. I would go to catch my flight, and it would take me like 20 minutes to get clear to fly. Like every time, I'm like, "What is going on?" Again, fortunately having never been in trouble, and eventually I found out that I was on a watch list, and this is 2003, 2004. And then I started after the Patriot Act, I would always get my financial packages in the mail and they would just be opened. And it was like, what is going on here? So, I don't know how I drifted off to that.
Well, we're talking about your name and you're saying it was Hebrew.
That watch list, they would be like, they told me like, your name matches the name of a terrorist or someone that they're watching. I was just like, what terrorist is running around with a Hebrew first name and the Arabic last? I'm like, who is that guy?
So who are you named after? It's an Old Testament name?
Isaiah, the prophet Isaiah's second son, was his symbolic name is Mahershala Al Hashbaz. And Prophet Isaiah was instructed to write the name in all capital letters as a prophecy. And it means hasten to the spoils, speedy is the prey. And I've been also been told that another meaning of it is divine restoration. So, yes.
Okay. So what made you think about acting? Did your father have anything to do with that?
My father had a lot to do with me thinking about acting, though he never saw me act. He passed away as I was doing my first play. But I just think being exposed to it and being around it, it wasn't something that I ever thought I couldn't do because I grew up around it. So when it finally came my way, and doors opened up for me to do it and to be on stage, it felt like a natural thing to try out, and it just so happened to speak to me. I really couldn't do what I needed to do in the most fulfilling way in Hayward, California, or in the Bay Area, that it required me to to go off to NYU, and that
where you studied acting, but you started off on a basketball scholarship at St. Mary's College.
I did.
Yeah. So, what was the transition between basketball and acting?
Well, I wanted to get that scholarship to a Division I scholarship and play ball and go to school for free. And that to me was, I was always about getting to that next step. If I could get to that next place, then I could figure out essentially what to do with being in that space and how to manage my time and handle handle all the benefits of being in that space in a way that would get me to the next place. And so I was always sort of ahead of myself in some way, shape, or form in trying to envision how to get further along and closer to fulfilling that dream of being free and having a creative agency, so to speak. And so getting to St. Mary's College was a big deal for me because that essentially led to me getting to go to NYU. And in my time at St. Mary's College, drifting out of sports because it was something that began to feel really finite. And I could see that I didn't have the passion to sustain a career in sports. I didn't have the passion for athletics in that way, that there were other parts of me that felt underserved and that needed to be nurtured and needed my energy. And so I played all 4 years at a certain point, basketball became the thing I was doing most, but it was really in my periphery. And it was really a focus on how to, in some ways, keep moving in this direction towards something that allowed me to express myself in a way that sports didn't.
When you started acting, were you concerned about there being a shortage of roles for Black actors?
Well, I got into it so late because of sports. And then when I was in grad school, I sort of got lulled into basically forgetting I was Black, in meaning that everyone you play at a conservatory, 95% of the characters are non-Black. So you don't even, you're thinking about how do I transcend this? How do I transform and be believable as Krogstad in a Doll's House, or Sir Peter Teasel in A School for Scandal? You know, these are things that are so far from my reality. And it's when you graduate is when you start to find yourself looking at the information in the audition breakdown, and it says tall Black African American built such and such, and you start seeing these character descriptions and seeing that, oh, you're only going in for the ones that are described as your look. And it and so if anything, in my mind, I never wanted to accept that. And so have always fought against that in some way, shape, or form, and have had people who have supported trying to get me in for things that were beyond the character description.
So a big break for you was a few years ago when you got cast in House of Cards, which is the Netflix series about a congressman turned president, very ruthless, played by Kevin Spacey. And you play somebody who had been his press secretary when he was majority whip, but then you become a partner in a major lobbying firm, and your main client at the beginning of the series is Sancor, which is a natural gas company that gives a lot of money to Frank Underwood, the Kevin Spacey character. But I'm going to play a scene from...
Okay.
This is actually your very first scene in House of Cards. And so at this point, so you're lobbying for Sancor, and Sancor is giving a lot of money to Frank Underwood, the Kevin Spacey character. He's been avoiding your calls. So the scene we're going to hear plays out in three parts.
First, I'm so glad you're bringing all this up, because I'm like, I don't remember any of that.
That was so long. It's like 5 years ago. I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. That's right. Okay. That's great.
Okay, so to refresh your memory further, yes. This scene plays out in three parts. First, you come up to talk to Frank Underwood in a restaurant. Then Underwood addresses the camera and talks about money and politics. And then you and Underwood have this meeting in the hall.
Right.
So the scene starts with you walking up to the restaurant table where Frank Underwood is having lunch with another congressman and the Speaker of the House. You speak first.
Congressman, sorry to interrupt, but I saw you sitting over here.
Remy. Gentlemen, this is Remy Denton. Remy, this is Speaker Birch.
I'm well aware, Mr. Speaker, Congressman.
Remy just made partner at Glendon Hill.
Glendon Hill? Great team over there. Congratulations.
Thank you.
When was the last time they added a partner?
It's been a while.
Well, they know a winner when they see one. Remy was the best press secretary I ever had.
Why'd you let him go?
I didn't. They stole him away.
What accounts do you have?
Sancorp Industries is my main one. I run that account now. Anyhow, I'll let you get back to it. Sorry again to interrupt.
No problem.
Very nice to meet you both.
Nice. These lobbyists keep getting younger and younger.
He's probably making more than all of us combined.
Gentlemen, this one's on me. I'm gonna track down that check. Glendon Hill fronts Sancorp Industries. Sancorp is deep into natural gas. I don't give a hoot about natural gas, but I have 67 deputy whips, and they all need cash to win races. Sancorp helps me purchase loyalty, and in return, they expect mine. It's degrading, I know, but when the is that big, everybody gets in line. Tell them I'm on top of it.
I need more than that.
You are well aware that I do not drop the ball on things like this, Remy.
Promises, Frank. Secretary of State, Argentina, the offshore drilling contract.
Talk to me when I've solved the problem. Don't waste my time when I'm working on solving it.
There's billions on the line. You can't not call me back, and I can't not show up.
Fine. Thank you for your diligence.
Eight figures to you in the DCCC. $6 million to build that library of yours in your name.
I know.
Don't make them throw money at your challenger next cycle.
You've made your point.
Have I? I hope so.
Okay, hardball politics there. So did you start paying a lot more attention to lobbying and politics after playing this part?
I started paying attention to, if anything, I became more curious about the story behind the story. So what was really going on behind the headline? And it's a little bit sad that show, it doesn't seem so much like entertainment the way it did back when we started doing it. You know, it felt like so far enough from the reality of things that we can enjoy it purely as entertainment. And now it feels a little bit too in alignment, honestly. But yeah, so we'll see how season 5 goes over there.
But you're not in season 5, right? You left the show.
No, I'm not. Not in season 5, so I can't I can't spoil anything for you, other than the fact that I'm not in it.
Right. So you're in two films now, nominated for Best Picture, Moonlight, and Hidden Figures. So in a way, you're competing against yourself. You're in a kind of strange position. At the same time, your wife is due to have. To have her baby, so
any minute now I could get a call while you and I are talking and I just have to dash away and finish this interview.
Wow, I think can hold on that long. We're almost done. Yeah. Hang in there.
No, I'm joking. We're a couple of days past the due date.
Oh, okay. So she's probably not going to be in labor on the day or the night of the... Okay, that's good.
So
you'll be a father by then.
Yes, fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed. So just one more question. So yes. I know you've made mixtapes, or imaginary mixtapes for characters that you've played to kind of help define who they are by figuring out what their taste is. So I imagine you made a mixtape playing Juan, the character that you play in Moonlight, who's a drug dealer, but also a surrogate father to this young boy. A lot of the music and the score for the film is more like chamber music. When you heard the scoring for the film, were you surprised at the music?
Not at all. Mm-hmm. Not at all. And the reason being is that for the first time in working with the director, Barry Jenkins, the director, said, I got some music, man, I want to send you. And I said, that's crazy, man, because I'm up here trying to like make this playlist for Juan, and I'm just having a little bit of trouble with it because he's just so,
he's so different from anyone I've ever played. And so I'm just trying to figure out, with him being from the South and being Cuban and being in my, so I'm really, really trying to find an in just sonically for this guy, especially because I was doing several other projects at that time. So I really needed something like a specific thing to kind of clue me into who I was playing and on what day. And Barry sent us, several of us, some music from not that it was necessarily intended to be in the movie, but it was music that inspired him while working on the film and sort of and essentially trying to set the tone for the movie. And I just thought that was so amazing because I always do that for my characters. So that was a case where I heavily leaned on music that he had in that playlist. Some of it was some what's called chopped and screwed, but basically slowed down. The BPMs are dropped way down. Chopped and screwed versions of Erykah Badu songs. And I believe there was like Outkast on there and Goody Mob, Frank Ocean, some Bach. That's what I can recall. And Aretha Franklin, I want to say. So there was a good bit of music that was there that really spoke to me and gave me a real sense of the character, the pace and feel, what the weather of Miami felt like, the spirit of the project. I had enough in there to go off of.
Mahershala Ali, it's been great to talk with you. I wish you very good luck at the Oscars.
Thank you, Terry.
And I wish your forthcoming baby a speedy and happy entrance into the world.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. It was good talking to you.
It's good talking to you. Be well. Thank you so much.
Oh, you too.
Mahershala Ali is nominated for an Oscar as Best Supporting Actor for his performance in Moonlight. He also co-stars in Hidden Figures. Both films are nominated for Best Picture. Let's hear a recording that's used in the soundtrack of Moonlight. This is Aretha Franklin singing One Step Ahead.
I'm only one step ahead of heartbreak, one step ahead of misery. One step is all I'd have to take backwards to be the same old fool for you I used to be. I'm only one step ahead of your arms, one kiss away from your sweet lips. I know I can't afford to stop for one moment, 'cause I'm just out of reach of your fingertips. Your shoulder keeps reminding me that it's too soon to forget you. It's too late to be free. Can't you see?
After we take a short break, Maureen Carrigan will review a new novel by the writer known as The Indian Chekhov. This is Fresh Air.